This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Lucy Hawkins from the Global Story podcast, where the BBC's Jeremy Bowen has been speaking to Ahmed al-Shara, the former jihadi and former rebel who is now leading Syria. How does he see the country's future? Does he have the power to make it a reality? And how worried should we be about his past? Find the Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Luke Jones from the BBC World Service. This is BBC OS Conversations, today with Syrian prisoners and their families. When Assad's regime fell, there was a defining moment when rebels freed inmates from Syria's prisons. Now we're getting a sense of just how terrible those places were. Centres for torture, starvation, murder. In our conversations, we'll hear from two survivors and bring together families whose loved ones were arrested.
They just came and took him from his office at the morning, and we didn't know anything about him, if he is alive or dead, for 3 years.
During his visit earlier this week to Sadnaya prison near Damascus, the BBC's international editor Jeremy Bowen described it as, quote, the dark and rotten heart of the Assad regime. Since the civil war started in the country in 2011, it's estimated that some 30,000 people were killed in that one prison. We may never know what happened to many of the 100,000 people, men, women and even children, who disappeared into the prison system under Assad's rule, many of them for simply expressing their opposition to the regime. I should say that before we hear our conversations, you might find some of the stories and experiences our guests share upsetting. Our first conversation is with two people who were detained in Syria. And because we felt it was so important to hear what they had to say, we're going to share almost all of the recording we made with them. Omar now lives in Sweden. He was 15 years old when he was imprisoned. And Noor, who's now living in the UK, spent a year in Syrian prison in 2014. My colleague Mark Lowen asked Noor, first of all, for his reaction to the fall of Assad.
I was crying. I was literally crying for hours. I didn't sleep that night because when the news were coming and saw Umayyad Square in the middle of Damascus, that was a miracle. Because 10 days ago, I was saying Assad can never fall and justice will never happen in Syria. I couldn't stop crying.
What does it mean for you, the fall of the regime?
It means justice. It means justice from a war criminal, which is Bashar al-Assad, and lots of war criminals who were helping him. So it's not only Assad for me. It means that lots of detainees who were neglected by the whole world, we're talking about more than 100,000 detainees, were about to get heard, or at least they will have relief and they are dead.
Omar, what went through your mind as you saw the regime falling?
It felt like a dream. I kept my hope high all the years, but I can't deny it. It was very difficult to keep my hope alive that the regime will fall and get us by surprise. It wasn't short time. It took a million lives in Syria, and it took the torture of so many innocent civilians and the displacement of 14 million Syrians. But in the end, this regime fell. And it was the tears of joy that dominated the moment. I cried like a baby. Of joy. I couldn't know before that I could cry that much of joy, actually.
Can I ask you both about your experience in prisons? I'm sorry, it must be a very difficult thing to open up about. And, you know, it's unimaginable for us to think what you went through. But I wonder if I can just ask you for your stories. Omar, what happened to you? When were you detained by the regime and why?
I was a little boy, a minor, when I was taken to prison and tortured and starved and see the death of my beloved ones one after one. But there are two sides to prison. The prisons I was in, there was the side where you can think about this miserable environment of hopelessness and helplessness and death and pain and the torture of your own body and the bodies of your beloved ones. And that's what the regime wanted us to to live through. That's what the regime wanted to break us through. Both the physical and the mental torture. And the physical, I don't even need to explain how a brutal regime like this could torture its people. But the mental torture, the prisoner, the guards that were torturing us were not randomly doing what they were doing. They knew that the psychological torture they are putting us through, from forcing us to torture each other or forcing us to choose one of us to be executed and to more things, they knew that this will have an impact on us forever, and they wanted to break us. But then on the other side, there is a positive side of being in that environment, because you're not sitting with any criminal. You're sitting with your people. You're sitting with the highly educated people of Syria. So the prisoner on my right was a doctor, on my left was a psychologist, in front of me is a lawyer, behind of me is an engineer, and the doctor was taking care of my wounds, and the psychologist talking to me about how to take care of our trauma, and everybody was teaching me something that I could use in my daily life in prison. And suddenly, what I was doing was giving me a function. I was helping other people, and that function became meaning. Suddenly, I found meaning in my life in that cell, and that gave me hope to keep going.
Why were you sent to prison? What was your alleged crime?
This is the very different thing about Syria. You don't do anything to go to prison. They take you to prison, and then they make you make, say, a false confession to put you in prison for a long time or to execute you. But you don't necessarily need to go on to be on the street to protest their government. You don't need to do anything in Syria to be taken as a political prisoner. They take you, and then they can find something for you to say. And that is something that the world may not have catched in the last 14 years, that you don't need necessarily to go to the street to ask for freedom and democracy to be arrested. And then under the torture, when they're pulling out your fingernails, you definitely give them any sort of false confession they want, because you just want the pain to stop now. You don't care about the future.
How horrendous. Noor, tell me what happened to you in 2014.
Okay, so for me, I was detained for a reason. And the reason was that I am against Assad, and I was helping civilians in besieged areas with food and medical supplies. This was the charge. So when they took me, they knew that I was helping people. They have got my name from many sources that this person was helping and going to besieged areas. So they took me in 2014. And by the way, I had a discussion with the detective and the head of the branch that took me. And I was asked that, why are you against Bashar al-Assad? This was the first question, because they opened my Facebook account. I told them I'm not against Assad. I'm against any tyrant. I'm against the injustice that's happening in Syria. And they told me that you were helping the families of the people against the regime. I told them that I was helping civilians. I was getting baby milk and baby formula to these areas. So who can use the baby milk? They told me it doesn't matter. You were helping the families of the people who are against the regime. I knew before 2014 that I was going to get detained someday. I hoped that I would be killed before. I mean, I prayed a lot that I want to be killed and I don't want to get detained. And I knew that I would get detained eventually. But when they got me, everything that I was preparing myself for, I read lots of novels and stories. And whenever a friend came out of the detainees, or I used to hear the details of the stories in order to prepare myself. Everything I heard was true. Everything I heard, I've seen it with my own eyes. And I have, and every kind of torture that that people would talk about, I've seen it. I've seen people that would die of torture in front of my eyes. I've seen people without any humanity. They're only called humans, but they're not humans. And they don't treat people like humans. They see us like not even animals. They used to see people like something like a table you don't care about.
It's hard to come up to work with words when you hear some of the experiences that you've had. I mean, you're both incredibly courageous to speak out and to have obviously gone through what you went through. Omar, I understand that you were actually in Sadnaya prison, which is the one where everybody has rushed to now as the inmates were freed. I mean, when you saw the scenes of people going to Sadnaya to try to discover their loved ones, bodies from the mortuary that showed signs of terrible torture being taken out now, did it just bring everything back for you?
Seeing Sadnaya prison again in videos and photos, seeing free people coming to it, families coming to it, seeing prisoners being running out of that place has been beautiful and hard at the same time. Not because it brings back bad memories, but it brings a reality that's going to be very difficult to accept, because most of the prisoners who made it to Sadnaya died in Sadnaya. The majority of the prisoners died under torture. So lots of the mothers that made it there will never be able to hug their sons or daughters again. And that's the most heartbreaking thing. How could you convince a mother that she doesn't see the body of her dead son, or doesn't have a paper or a document that he died, that her son actually died? That's why they want to dig more under the ground, under Sadnaya, under Branch 215. They want to dig everywhere, because you can't prevent a human being from having hope that they will find what they've been looking for so many years, especially when it's someone that's a piece of you, your son, your family member. So that's the heartbreaking reality that we've been talking about for a long time, but it's been very difficult for anyone to accept that most people in Syrian prisons die under torture.
You know, sometimes you don't wish for life, you wish for death. And when you are a detainee, sometimes you wish for death. You don't want to live anymore because of the torture, because of everything. You don't want to live anymore. So now I feel that at least the detainees, I know it's painful, but they had a closure. This is not easy. I mean, I used to say it. For 1 month, I used to wish, okay, I wish I would die. I don't want to live anymore. Now I'm happy because families will have a closure, even if it's a hard closure.
Do you have closure?
I don't have closure. No, I don't have closure. I will have closure when I see justice in place. Okay. I will have.
And what does justice look like for you?
Justice means that everyone who was helping in any kind of this criminal act, that he would be got into court, and the people who were killing, they should have the right justice for them. This is one of the closures that might help me, but I don't know if I will ever have a closure, because for me, I remember my friends who were with me. I mean, they died. What kind of closure could I have after 14 years? I want to stay angry at them. I want to stay angry, and I want to remember every detail, every small detail of torture, because I want to stay angry at them.
Do you want to say something to them? Do you want to express your pain?
Can you imagine someone who has been torturing people for at least 14 years and has killed many, many, many people? What can you say to them? I forgive you? No, I don't forgive them. And any kind of sentence that they would get, it would be much less than what they deserve.
I think Syrians have the capability, after 14 years of suffering and pain, they have the capability to build a country that accepts the other. That being said, justice is important. And the first step towards justice was bringing down the regime that's been killing people and torturing people for so many years. And now this is checked. The regime is gone. Now we have to bring at least the people on the top who had the power to give order for torture and starvation and killing, and the people who had the power to give order for chemical weapon attacks. Those, we need to bring them to justice. Those need to be in court. I doubt that we will be able to prosecute everyone who committed crimes. We won't be able, because the number is so huge, and that will never end. It takes 100 years in Syria. That is the consequence of such a long revolution, such a long war. I have learned with the time to find peace in what I went through. And it gives me closure that the regime that's been trying to deny us our freedom and arrested us for asking for freedom and democracy is now gone. And my revenge in this way is to be able to make sure that we keep the freedom we have and to build the system that can respect the human rights regardless of their background or opinions.
Omar and Noor sharing their experiences of surviving Syrian prison. I'm Luke Jones, and from the BBC World Service, you're listening to BBC OS Conversations.
I'm Lucy Hawkins from the Global Story podcast, where the BBC's Jeremy Bowen has been speaking to Ahmed al-Shara, the former jihadi and former rebel who is now leading Syria. How does he see the country's future? Does he have the power to make it a reality? And how worried should we be about his past? Find the Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Syria's interim leader, Ahmed al-Shara, also known previously as Abu Mohammed al-Julani, has said he will dismantle the country's security forces and hunt those involved in the killing or torture of detainees. But it's thought that many of them may have already fled. As the Assad regime collapsed, families headed to the prisons to search for their loved ones or evidence of what happened to them. They were confronted by the squalid and inhuman conditions that prisoners had been kept in, but also documents scattered around the offices, making it harder for them to find out the fate of their relatives. Over the past few days, videos have also been posted online about mass graves where the regime buried those tortured to death. We brought together Maan in the southern city of Dara. His older brother Munir was arrested in 2014 after taking part in protests. And Hibba, whose father was arrested in Aleppo in 2011. She now works for a charity helping to look for missing people in Syria.
They just came and took him from his office at the morning. And we didn't know anything about him, if he is alive or dead, for 3 years. And then he managed to send us a letter via someone who was with him. After that, he managed to call us when they moved him to a civil prison. And we knew that he is alive and he is in some place in Damascus. And we sent a lawyer and my uncles went to visit him. Mm. And we started this journey by paying bribes to the people inside this prisons and the security prisons. He stayed there until 29th of November, 2024.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what was it like that first time that you actually heard him on the telephone? That must have been quite a moment for you.
Yes. And he called me directly to my phone. He only knows my number. He didn't save my mother's number or any other one. And he called me. My dad has a very special voice. "Hi, Hibba, this is me, your dad." I told him, "No, who are you?" He told me, "This is me, daddy." So I was just in shock. He told me that I'm in Adra prison. "Please call your uncles and call a lawyer to come. They will take me to the court soon. So I need someone to be there."
We were at home and the door knocked and the policeman came inside and he looking for someone. He took him and put the shirt on his head. And my mother tried to push him to don't take my brother, but he didn't answer. He told her to just keep quiet. So he took him in a car. And after 2 months, when I come back from my school, I saw a man in our house with a big beard. Like, he looks like an homeless. He was one that get out of the place that they took my brother. He was a prisoner there. He told me, "Your brother Munir is miss you. He want to see you and tell you to try to get him out of there."
Have you heard any news since then about your brother?
We tried a lot. My mother tried and pay money. If you want to know that this name and where is it, you have to pay money to the government, to the said system. You have to pay, like, for example, 1 million just to know where it is, just to know the place. And there's many prices, like, for example, 2 million to see him. and 5 million to send him something. And in the end, we discovered that it's all lies. They used money, they take our money, and we didn't know anything, any information. It was lies.
But of course, that regime is now no more, and we've seen certain prisons liberated by rebel forces and prisoners released and found. Amongst all of that, have you had any further news about your brother, Munir, or are you still in the dark?
After the revolution is, after Assad leave and the prisoners are out, in last 4 days, I looked for him. I go to Palestine prison and ask. They told me they are all out now. Go to the hospitals and search there. I went to the hospitals and there were many people there. I saw bodies to men died, and a picture, a hard picture, very, very hard picture to see. It's harmful. And I put his name there in the hospital. But yesterday we have news, he is dead. They sent us when he's dead, and I don't know what the word in English had to find. So he is dead in 2014 in Damascus, under. So he's dead now.
So your brother was actually killed because, shortly after he was arrested,
Yes.
Actually, I'm really sorry to hear that, but this story, it's the same with many thousands of families inside Syria now.
Most
the detainees, they were killed after 2 months, 3 months of detention. And this is a devastating information now we are getting for our loved ones.
Man, you now know what happened to your brother, and that he unfortunately died 10 years ago now. Now you know that, and I guess you're hearing more and more stories about the cruelty that happened to people like your brother at the hands of the regime. How does that, well, first of all, how does that make you feel? And how does that make you feel about what the future could hold for you and your family and the country, and whether these kind of wounds could be healed?
Now I have many feelings right now. One of them, I'm sad that he was only 17 years old when they took him. So he didn't see anything of his life. He didn't live, he had to live more to see. He was too young for dying. This one thing. The other thing, I hope now, all the people, they do wrong things and they hurt people, they should punish now. I hope that. And we are all the Syrian now optimistic about what the future. We have hope, we are happy now, but all this happiness, it's, how can I explain it? It's happiness and sadness together.
Man and Hibba, and we wish them both all the best and their families as well for the future. I'm Luke Jones, and you've been listening to BBC OS Conversations with Syrian prisoners and their families from the BBC World Service.
I'm Lucy Hawkins from the Global Story podcast, where the BBC's Jeremy Bowen has been speaking to Ahmed al-Shara, the former jihadi and former rebel who is now leading Syria. How does he see the country's future? Does he have the power to make it a reality? And how worried should we be about his past? Find the Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.